A Misfortune Free Man, Chapter 4, Woburn, 1740 to 1779. Ichabod Richardson was a good man, inclined to be stern and with a leaning toward silence. He had had slaves before, and he prided himself in knowing how to treat them, teach them a trade through the week, make Christians of them on Sunday, pay them, not what he would a white man, but what he deemed a just consideration for their service, and give them their freedom before they became too old to enjoy it. When the end of the day came, and they had reached the village of Woburn, though few words had been exchanged during the journey, Ichabod Richardson, Tanner, and Amos Fortune, Chattel, knew enough about each other to know that they would work well together. Mr. Richardson went into the house, where he was greeted by his wife and family. Amos led the horse to the barn and cared for it. Then he returned to the house. Briefly, the master tanner showed the slave apprentice his living quarters and told him to be in the kitchen for prayers the morning meal at half after five the next day. Amos seemed loath to leave, so Mr. Richardson asked him if there was anything about the work he wanted to know before the morning. Amos smiled and shook his head. Then he asked the question that had been foremost in his mind all day. "Thank you, sir," he said respectfully, and then more boldly, "I'll ask you to tell me when your paper advises you of a ship in from Africa at the Boston Wharf. If you'd be sending some leather to Boston, I'd like to take it on that day." Mr. Richardson clicked his teeth. "There are nothing like the number of slave ships coming in now that there used to be, Amos. But I'll let you know when I hear of one." Then severity tightened his lips. "But you'll have that privilege only on good behavior." Amos flashed a knowing smile. If he understood one thing clearly, it was that no good came to a slave except as a reward for his behavior. He took the candle from Mrs. Richardson's outstretched hand and the plate of food she had ready for him. Then he went across the grass to the hut that was Mr. Richardson's workshop, and would be Amos's home for all the years of his servitude. From the house, Ichabod Richardson and his wife heard the slave singing to himself long after he had blown out his candle to save the precious tallow. Mrs. Richardson tilted her head to listen. "If you had a slave for no other reason than their singing, I often think it would be worth it," she said. "And yet, so long as they're not free, their songs are like those of birds in a cage. He'll have his freedom in time, but not until he's paid me well for the price I paid for him." The years went on, and Amos learned the trade of a tanner. He worked well with the hides, and as in the kindly Quaker household in Boston, he soon made himself an indispensable part of the Richardson family. He fulfilled Mr. Richardson's requirements to profess Christianity, thereby justifying in large measure the expenditure Mr. Richardson had made. Amos went to church for 2 long hours in the morning and again in the afternoon, observing with respect the laws that pertain to the Sabbath during the hours when he was not under the vigilant eye of the minister. It puzzled Amos that the white people put so much stress on Sunday, yet it seemed somehow similar to the stress they put on the color of a man's skin. To Amos, once he understood the Lord, every day was lived to him. It was not in the meeting house alone, but in the tan yard that he took delight in being a Christian. It was not with his own people he felt at his best, but with all men. He was to go to the end of his days without fully understanding the white man's attitude to the color of a man's skin. But it did not trouble or vex him the way it did some of the other slaves with whom he met and talked. It puzzled him, but then there were many things to puzzle a man. And as the years went on, there were years fraught with the excitement of great events. The colonies were seething with the rush of bold ideas. As taxation grew more unjust and the long arm of authority wielded across an ocean grew more tyrannical, liberty became the word that warmed the people's hearts and fired the tongues of their spokesmen. The new country that had established itself with such eager rapidity was feeling more sure of itself. In the strength that had been born and tested through the subdue of a wilderness, it had begun to dare to assert its independence. From time to time, Mr. Richardson would read in the Gazette or the newsletter the advice of a ship soon to arrive at Boston Harbor with human merchandise. Remembering his agreement with Amos, he would send his slave with a cartload of leather to Boston on the day of the ship's arrival. It was no hardship for him to part with his slave for such a purpose, for he had early learned that Amos could drive a better bargain than he could. For some time he had been letting Amos do all the selling of the leather. With his permission to Amos to be at large for a day, he gave him a written paper stating to any who might be concerned the nature of the slave's business. Were Amos delayed and seen on the streets after 9 at night without such a paper, he would be whipped by the constable no matter what explanation he might offer. Amos did not rely solely on the advices in the papers. He watched the advertisements as well. These were often for single slaves to be sold privately or at auction. He made a notation in the small book he always carried on his person of those he would see on his next time in Boston. One advertisement interested him especially. 3 Negro men and 2 women to be sold and seen at the house of Mr. Josiah Greenwood in Center Street. Houses and taverns were often used as showrooms for human chattels, and Amos preferred seeing them in such places. He went to the house in Center Street and tried to talk to the 5 Africans, waiting patient and solid for the exchange of money that would give them a home and occupation. But they knew no words of English, and Amos had a few words of the Admonshi tongue, even had they once spoke it. It was his continuing sorrow that he had not been able to hold more of his early speech in memory. Once he had learned to write English, he had tried to recall certain words of the Admonshi so he might record them for himself, but they were not there. Search through his mind as he might, and with all the longing of his heart, they were not there. The dark faces of the Africans sitting in Mr. Josiah Greenwood's kitchen looked at him. Amos held out his hand to them, trying to tell them in some way that their new life might be yet happy. But their faces remained impassive, and Amos thought that even though they might understand him, they would not believe him. Most Africans had already suffered so much at the hands of white men that they regarded every white man as his enemy. Amos never pursued an advertisement that spoke only of Negro men or boys, for he was not interested in them. Always he was looking for a young girl whose voice ranged like a bird's through her though her limbs would carry her at no more than a snail's pace. An advertisement describing a Negro woman, 19 years, and her infant 6-month-old to be sold either together or apart, attracted Amos. But when he saw the woman, she was not beautiful as Athmoon had been. She was sullen and silent, though she had been in the country several years, and her former master declared her English to be tolerably good. On the same day, Amos traced yet another advertisement. Selling for cash or short credit, a Negro wrench about 18 years of age, strong and healthy, used to all kinds of work indoors and out. The above wench is sold for no fault of her own, the owner at present having no employ for her. But when he saw her, he knew she was not the one he was seeking. So Amos returned to Woburn with the money for the leather and news for Mr. Richardson of what was doing at the wharfs and in the taverns. And always he brought some small trinket for Mrs. Richardson. One time it was a mirror made of highly polished tin. It was the finest present Amos had ever brought to her, and he did it for 2 reasons. One, because it caught his eye, and the other, because he was soon to be promised his freedom. 20 years and more he had done the work of a tanner, grown as a member of the household, and satisfied Ichabod Richardson. That knowledge, as well as the air he breathed, gave him the boldness to ask for his freedom rather than to wait indefinitely upon Mr. Richardson's will. On a December evening in 1763, he made a bargain with his master, agreeing to all Mr. Richardson's reasonable conditions, but insisting that 6 years from that date he was to be a free man. When all was agreed to, Amos took from inside his shirt the polished tin sheet and handed it to Mrs. Richardson. A piece of finery it was, a vanity that might have been scoffed at by many New England housewives, but that all would value nonetheless. Even though true enjoyment of it might only come in secret, she stood it against the candlestick, standing away to see herself in it. It was a quiet face, and a kind of face that smiled back at her in the soft tallow glow. But so no one could accuse her of vanity, she spoke quickly. "Ah, Amos, I'm not the same person that I was when you first came here." "Some folks only grow more beautiful," Amos smiled. "But we all grow older," Mrs. Richardson said warmingly. "Why, even you, Amos, see for yourself." So Amos stood before the sheet and saw his own face, black and strong, eyes bright, teeth white, close-cropped hair slowly gray. 50 years had rolled down him, and though muscles and brawn could do the work they had always done, and hope still led him on, time had left its mark. Then the gay smile flickered from his face, and the flash in his eyes went out as he put his hands across them to take away what he had seen. Not his own face, but Athmoon's, had looked at him from the polished tin. Long and lovingly as he had sought her, he had not found her because always he had been seeking for a young girl. The years had done no less to Athmoon than they had to him. She had become a woman, and he had become a man. A sob wrecked him. He turned to Mrs. Richardson and looked at her for a moment with eyes like snuffed candles had no light in them. Then, putting his hands across his face again, he stumbled out of the room. They heard him late that night singing in the darkness tannery. "You got to cross that Jordan River. You got to cross it for yourself. Oh, there can't be nobody cross it for you. You got to cross it for yourself. Can't be your brother cross it for you. You got to cross it for yourself." "What happened to him?" Ichabod Richardson asked. "I don't know," his wife replied. "Amos looked at himself in the little mirror he brought me, and at first his image seems to delight him. Then it affected him strangely. Perhaps he thought he was white until he saw himself in the mirror." Mrs. Richardson shook her head. "Perhaps, but it's more than that. There is a yearning in him that it has its roots in the land from which he came. Oh, it's a terrible thing we've done, Mr. Richardson, to bring these black people to our land and treat them as we do. There's lots not too hard," he remonstrated. "Ah, but until they're given their freedom, they count no more than cattle." Ichabod Richardson sighed deep. "They're not the only ones to be thinking about freedom. Before many more years have passed, we'll be thinking about it too, and not as people, but as a nation." "What do you mean, Mr. Richardson? "I mean that we've made other slaves readily enough, but we'll be slaves ourselves if we don't keep watch." While Amos sang to comfort himself, Ichabod Richardson drew up the paper that would mean the ultimate freedom of his slave. As he wrote, he was buoyed by a sense of generosity and uprightness. "Know all men by these presents," his quill made a graceful flourish with the final letter, "that I, Ichabod Richardson of Woburn, in the county of Middlesex, and province of Massachusetts Bay in New England, tanner for diverse goods, me here unto especially moving have, and by these presents do covenant, promise, grant, and agree to, and with my negro man Amos, that at the end of 4 years next, insinuating this date, or at my decease, if it should fall within that term, that he, the said Amos, shall be discharged, freed, and set at liberty from my service, power, and command forever, and have full liberty to trade, traffic, and dispose of himself in all respects as he pleases, and have and enjoy and convert to his own use all the profit of his own labor and industry, equal to men that are free-born, and that neither I nor my heirs, nor any other persons, or persons acting or claiming by, or under me, nor them shall have challenge, or claim any right to, or in his person property, or labors, but therefrom shall be excluded and forever declared by force and virtue of these presents, in witness whereof I, the said Ichabod Richardson, have hereunto set my hand and seal the 13th day of December, 1763, in the fourth year of His Majesty's reign. It was late when Mr. Richardson finally snuffed the candle and put on his nightcap, but his wife was wakeful and waiting for him in the double bed with his heavy hanging curtains. He told her of all that he had done, and she smiled with relief in the darkness that her husband had at last made sure the freedom of his faithful slave. "I shall talk with Simon Carter in the morning," Ichabod said, "and Amos shall pay to him the full indenture. He's a banker and will take care of it as a trust fund, so in case Amos is unable to work at any time due to sickness, you and the children will be cared for. Then our pounds and pence paid by Amos himself, your diverse goods, good reasons," his wife questioned, "with certainty." "You are a hard man, Ichabod Richardson," she said quietly. She had said it before in silence. She voiced it now in words. Amos was pleased the next morning when he was shown the paper and the fact that he would have to buy his own freedom by paying an agreed sum for the next several years to Mr. Carter did not dilute his pleasure. He could look ahead to a fortune of freedom achieved by his own efforts and not through the kindness of any man. It was well that Amos Fortune's freedom was established, for the paper granting it survived Ichabod Richardson. Soon after the tanner's death, Mrs. Richardson saved Amos further investment in his freedom by a quick claim of her interest in the fund into which Amos was paying. She drew up a paper of her own, brief and clear, in which she said, "In consideration of the many faithful services Amos Fortune did perform to the said deceased Ichabod in his lifetime, and hath since performed to us respectively, whereby our several interests have been greatly increased, I do grant unto Amos Fortune the full and free liberty of his person from and after the 19th day of May, 1769. It was a strange thing to wake up on that morning of the 19th of May and know that he was a free man. Amos took the paper out of his pocket and read it again to assure himself that he returned it. Then he returned it to his pocket. It was a paper that he would carry on his person until the day of his death. He tidied his small room and did up his affairs in a bundle. He had no more than he could carry on his back, his Bible, a change of garments, and a pair of silver buckles that he wore on his shoes on Sundays. Then he stood in the doorway and breathed the air that was sweet with blossom and alive with birdsong, and it seemed that now he was free, he could breathe more deeply. He watched swallows swooping in their flight, feeling as if he were one of them. His eyes dwelt on a tree that was a mass of white blossom. It had been spring, too. He had been free before. The new strength of the sun with which he had matched his strength had been at hand. The growing of the year with which he would grow had been ahead. Yet that had been a lifetime ago, another life. Perhaps for now his life was beginning again. He was almost 60 years old, and he was ready to live. He flexed his muscles. They were strong. He raised his head from the blossoming tree to the blue sky above, and the thought of Moses came into his mind, of Moses who stood upon Mount Nebo, seeing with his eyes the land that his feet might not tread upon. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. Amos spoke the words as reverently as if they were reading from the open book. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural force abated. That was true for him, he thought. "So there's time for Amos, too," he murmured. "Time the same for him as it was for Moses, because for them both there was something to live for. When a man had that, he could go on for a long time." Amos crossed the small garden he had set out and cared for to the house to say goodbye to Mrs. Richardson. She was busy with the morning meal, but at sight of Amos, she ceased what she was doing. "Where are you going, Amos?" she asked. "I don't know, ma'am. Somewhere that I can work and establish a home. It's only half a home without a wife. Have you thought of anyone, Amos?" She gestured to his place at the table. Setting his bundle down, Amos drew up to the table, as he had for years past. "Indeed, I have. And when I save up my money again, I'll buy her and make her mine." "Again, Amos?" Then Mrs. Richardson blushed. Well, she knew that Amos' hard-earned savings had all gone to buy his own freedom. Even the date of manumission set by her husband 4 years from the document drawn up in 1763 had meant nothing because of the sum he had stipulated between himself and Amos. Toward that sum, Amos would have been paying yet had she not drawn up her own document. Then Mrs. Richardson told Amos of the plan she had been considering, that he work on at the tannery and slowly establish it as his own. Amos smiled with delight, but he had his own pride, and he would accept nothing without fair payment. He agreed to work on with the tools and vats he had been handling for years past while he built his own home and business, then settled for himself. It took Amos 4 years to establish his trade and build a homestead for himself. But by then, he was accepted as a citizen of Woburn. He worked during the day, saving a few hours off when he would leave the tanning and become carpenter on his own account. Every evening except Sunday, during the fourth year, he presented himself at the kitchen door of the house of Jonathan Twobly and asked to see Lily. Lily had been a slave for 40 years, sometimes faring well, often ill, at the hands of her many masters. Amos had met her years ago at one of the African gatherings. From the first he had loved her, but he would not let himself think of her as a wife until, in asking her hand for marriage, he could offer her freedom. Lily would have married him as a slave, and it would not have been out of keeping in the Twobly household to have allowed her to marry while still remaining at her as a slave. But Amos would not have it so. "We'll wait a while," he said to her comfortingly. "We blacks are used to waiting." And Lily, lovingly, Amos had, and trusting him in everything, agreed to wait. The tide of events was rolling on. Much of the world was thrilled. Some of it stood aghast when on a December day in 1773, tea was dumped in Boston Harbor because the colonists refused to pay a tax when they had no representation in Parliament. But another event had happened in the same year, though it caused no furor. A petition had been presented to the Massachusetts legislature by a group of Boston Negroes deploring the severance of families through sale. Even the spy slave was becoming vocal. The wind of freedom that was passing over the world left nothing untouched. Wherever there was oppression, something began to stir. When the end would be, no one knew, but it was bound to result in the right of every man to be free. Talking of such things in the warmth of the big kitchen, Amos would repeat, "We've still a while to wait." One day, toward the end of the fourth year, Amos presented himself at the front door of Mr. Twobly's house, asking to see Mr. Twobly himself. He was ushered into the gentleman's presence, though he would go no further than the entrance to the room. Standing in the doorway and holding his beaver hat in his hands, he made his request known. "I'd like to buy your Lily," he said quietly. "I have the money." Mr. Twobly looked at him sharply. "Lily is still worth 20 pounds to me," he said, and then added, "That's the price I prayed for her when I bought her 7 years ago." Amos counted out 20 pounds and handed the notes to the surprised Mr. Twobly before he could change his mind or raise the price. After Mr. Twobly had pocketed the money, he asked Amos what he wanted the woman for. "I want to marry her." "She won't make you much of a wife," he laughed harshly. "She's been ailing the past year. She may not have long to live. Then she can die free, Amos said, as he bowed and left the gentleman's presence and went out to find Lily, his now, and a free woman because she was his. Lily died within the year, but Amos had the satisfaction of knowing that she died free. And in that October of 1775, freedom was the byword of every American. But even while Lily was his wife, Amos thought of Athmon, now only a faint, frail part of memory, but still dear. He hoped that in making one black woman free, he had made Athmon free, if she was in need of freedom. On a raw day during the winter, when Amos was delivering a load of leather to the house of Josiah Bowers in nearby Bellerica, he accepted the cook's invitation to stop by the kitchen hearth for a bowl of soup while he waited for Mr. Bowers' return for his pay. There were servants and slaves around the hearth, and Amos felt a good company, listening to their stories, telling his own, joining into songs together. None sang more littingly, nor laughed more sweetly, than the black woman Lydia. But when she rose to leave the kitchen to answer the bell, she dragged herself across the floor with an aid of a crutch. After she had left the room, silence fell on the group around the hearth. "You've got big eyes for Lydia, old man," the cook said. "How is it she's so lame?" Amos asked, almost whispering the words. "She wasn't always lame," the cook replied. "She broke her leg in the ship coming over. She hasn't walked right since. But she's Mrs. Bower's sewing woman, and she doesn't need legs for that." "Is she married?" Amos asked. "No, laws, no," the cook exclaimed. "Whoever would marry Lydia?" When Mr. Bowers returned, Amos was called in to see him. After he had paid him for the leather, Amos said respectfully that he would like to transact some business of his own. "And what is it?" Mr. Bowers asked, wondering what he had that the Negro had taken a fancy to. "Your slave Lydia," Amos said. "I want to buy her." Josiah Bowers thought for a moment. "I can't sell her cheap. She's a well-trained servant. She can cook and sew, and she's a good disposition, which is high in her favor." "She is lame," Amos said. "She can be yours for 50 pounds. "Is that agreed between us?" Amos asked. "If you wish it so, and if you have my price, you have my price." "I do, and I will have in time," Amos said as solemnly as if he were taking an oath. "But what do you want her for? Her kind of needlework won't be of any use in your trade, and she's as lame as a spavined horse. I want to marry her." Josiah Bowers laughed tolerantly. "They say there's no accounting for the whims of a man's heart." Amos, sure as his part of the bargain, put his beaver hat on his head, buttoned his great coat, and went on his way back to Woburn. The flame of hope that had leapt up in him at his first sight of the limping black woman had soon gone out, but the wind did not blow as cold as it had earlier in the day. It took Amos 3 years to save up the sum for Lydia, 3 years during which a war was in the fighting and victory long in coming. The struggling colonies had been bound together by words on a parchment, words that said, "All men are created equal." Words that were to become the foundation stone of a nation. Words easily ascribed to and in the enthusiasm of youth when they signified breaking the bonds of restriction and tyranny. Words hard to explain to the black man who looked at the white for wisdom and understanding. Many of Amos's friends joined the ranks of the colonists, fighting well and fearlessly. Some of them gave their lives on the battlefield. There was no difference then in the blood that poured from severed veins, that of a black man or a white could water as well the soil from which freedom was growing. Of the blacks who survived the fighting, many were given their own freedom as a reward for service. Amos longed to be with them. But what was a man far advanced as his 60 to do? Offer his services as he might, prove his strength as he could, yet always he was told, "Too old for the rigors of the battlefield, the hardships, too old, too old." Yet Amos knew he was never too old to wage his own war for freedom in his own way, not with guns or valor, but hard-earned coinage, buying manumisms and giving it before it was too late, for one he loved to die in honor. Freedom was in the air no less than it was in Amos's blood. It had been his tradition, something vital as his own heart beats. He could not explain how such an intensity of feeling came to him. He knew only that it was there. Once every week, during the 3 years he worked to earn the sum for Lydia's freedom, he drove his cart to Bellerica and sat in the kitchen with Lydia, talking to her when the other servants were there or long after they had left them alone. A glow came over his face when he told her that he wanted to make her free. She put her hand on his, smiling up at him. "I never thought I would know freedom. What is it like, Amos? Is the air sweeter to breathe? Is the sun warmer? Can you remember what it was like in Africa?" She shook her head. "No, only the voyage. We were so wrecked. We tried to escape. Even the ocean would have been better. Some of us did." She put her hands to her eyes. "I can see them now, jumping into the water that meant freedom. I tried it, but we did not escape. They broke our legs." "I can't remember anything, Amos. after that but the pain and the long, dark days and nights. They never let us out of the hold again, and I saw no day until it was in the land, in this land. They were alone in the kitchen, and she put her hand on his shoulder and sobbed as if the tears she had not wept for 20 years were coming at last. He sang to her softly, and he told her what he could remember about Africa, and Lydia smiled. 6 days would have to pass, she thought to herself, before he would be sitting with her again in the kitchen, and yet they would be 6 days nearer to the time when they would be always together. Amos had no other thought than to pay the full price. He would not bargain over human flesh, nor was it for him to question Mr. Bower's decision. When the day came that he could call for Lydia in the cart, he presented himself first to Mr. Bowers. In the presence of witnesses, one who was a friend of Josiah Bower's, and one, the household servants, who was Amos' fortune friend, the money was counted carefully out. Mr. Bower set it aside. Then he handed Amos the necessary confirmation of the transaction. It was another bit of paper that Amos would treasure all the days of his life. Balearica, June, ye, 23, 1778. Then received of Amos Fortune £50 in full for a Negro girl named Lydia Somerset, being now my property, the which I do sell and convey to the aforesaid Amos, and I do covenant with the same Amos that I have just and lawful right to sell and convey the said Lydia in manner aforesaid, and I will warrant and defend the said Lydia to him against all the lawful claims and demands of all persons whatsoever. Signed, sealed, and delivered, in the presence of her, Millicent Brayden, Isaac Johnson, Josiah Bowers. To Amos, it was a cherished possession, and it was to live far longer than Lydia. Freedom was almost too sweet for her, and she enjoyed it for only a year. Amos was beside her bed when she died. He was happy in the confidence that she had gone forward as a free woman.